Open up your Bibles to the book of Isaiah, if you would. I'm going to start a lesson series looking at the book of Isaiah. This is one that I did a while ago. And the point of this it's six sermons that looks at different parts of the book of Isaiah so that we can have a sense for what the different sections are like and the different themes or the different ways that the prophet Isaiah speaks in his book. Because it's massive. It's a big book. It's not the biggest in the Old Testament. Jeremiah's got that one, and then he has Jeremiah Part 2, which is Lamentations. So Jeremiah is the big one, but Isaiah is the one that I've been reading a lot and feel pretty comfortable with, and I wanted to put together a series of lessons to communicate different themes and ideas and styles and sections through the book. And so the way it's going to work is in the parts that I've divided it up into sections in the way I see groupings in the book, and I'm going to do a sermon or two from each little section so that you can have a taste for it, and that way you will then be able to say, okay, chapters 1 through 5 are like this, because Daniel, that preacher guy, did a lesson on chapter 1, and chapters 1 through 5 are going to sound like chapter 1. But chapter 6 is not going to sound like chapter 1, and so you can look at chapter 6 on your own. I'm also planning on skipping the chapters you know, so you're not going to get a sermon on chapter 6, because you know chapter 6. And you're not going to get a sermon on Isaiah chapter 53, because you know Isaiah chapter 53. I break my rule, and I do one on Isaiah 40, which is somewhat well-known. The voice crying in the wilderness, we talked about that in the sermon this morning. That's where the voice crying in the wilderness quote comes from. So I don't really hold to that perfectly, but I liked chapter 40, and it happens. So this is what I hope to do on the Sunday evening lessons, is use this as an opportunity to give you an overview of the way Isaiah speaks and works and what he's trying to do so that you can then read Isaiah. So it's not going to be comprehensive. It's not going to cover everything in the book. It's going to cover every kind of experience that you'll get when you read through the book of Isaiah. Chapters 1 through 5, I'm planning on putting together a PowerPoint. I didn't do it for today, but it'll happen. And I'm going to have the different chunks as I've divided it. And chapters 1 through 5 are the sermons. I can't remember where I had read this, but I think it's a good description. These are the sermons that Isaiah preached almost every day from every street corner. It is easy. It is punchy. It is in-your-face direct. It is no holds barred, both in absolute condemnation and absolute bliss and joy. I mean, they're just really easy to wrap your mind around. Chapter 1 is just one of my favorites. Chapter 1 is the book of Isaiah in a nutshell. So when you read chapter 1, well, now you know what the other 60 chapters are going to be like. It's like this in a lot of ways. And so this is just a fun way to start. I'll read verse 1 because, you know, Isaiah gives us this little bit, at least for the context. The visions of Isaiah, the son of Amoz, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. Now, one of the things that I do with Old Testament history is I remember the big themes and I forget all the names. I don't necessarily forget the names on purpose, but I don't cry about it when I do forget the names because there's this thing called the internet. And I type in a Bible name in the internet and it tells me who and what it is. And we're going through it in one of our Bible classes and we're memorizing some of those things. And so I'm going to work on memorizing those names that we're working on there. But you can type in these names of chapter 1, verse 1 and get a decent sense as to where we are. In our Bible class on the kings, we are way at the beginning of this divided kingdom mess. And so we were talking about Jeroboam and Rehoboam and how Jeroboam, he built those idols, and then the rest of the story is just bad. It's just bad, and it's bad, and it's bad, and it's bad. This book is not about that. It's not about the top of the timeline. This is for and about the bottom of the timeline, but in the days of Hezekiah, which is the fourth guy he lists here, right? I was writing this down during these four guys. In the days of Hezekiah, the northern kingdom gets destroyed, annihilated, and deported. And nowadays, we actually describe what happens to the northern kingdom as genocide, forcibly moving an entire nation of people to somewhere else in the world. That qualifies under the definition of genocide, to kind of put it into the context of how severe this is. So Isaiah is writing this set of sermons and prophecies to the southern kingdom before, during, and after the northern genocide. So that's a big deal. That's scary. We have four kings, and I had in my notes that three out of four of them were good, and I had to look up which one was bad because I forgot. I was pretty sure it was Ahaz, and it was Ahaz. Ahaz is not a good king. But think about this. Four kings, and three out of four of them are good? That's kind of a rarity, right? So this is pretty good stuff. So we have three out of four of these kings are good. Yeah, the northern kingdom's totally annihilated, but things are good. One of the major themes, you'll see it in this chapter and through the whole book, is you better examine yourself before you ruin yourself. And the other theme is God saying, do you trust me? And we're going to realize that it doesn't matter if you've got three out of four good kings. Y'all are a mess. That's what this book is trying to say. Y'all are a mess. Do you trust me in that? Things are going to happen. Do you trust me in that? This is God, not me. You don't have to trust me. You want to trust God. You need to do these sorts of things and make these sorts of changes. And God says, do you trust me about that? So that's the context. That's as much as I'm going to give you for the context. You can look on the internet and look in your commentaries for some other ideas. But the north is about to and then gets destroyed. And this is the message that's around that time, before, during, and a little bit after that time. Okay, I want to see if there's anything else I need to say in my notes here. Again, the theme is, what's Isaiah like so that you can read Isaiah? That's really my goal. I want you all to read Isaiah on your own. And when you read the book of Isaiah, you have a couple options, and one of your options is to study it. I recommend that you read it. Do you see the difference there? It's big. Just read the thing. You don't have to study it yet. Read through the book, get a sense of what it feels like and sounds like, and then if there are chapters or parts that you thought was interesting, or if you want to slowly study the book, then study the book. But sometimes the Bible just needs to be read because it's really exciting stuff and really beautiful language. That reminds me of one point I wanted to say. Just to show you how some of these sections differ. In Isaiah 41, so way towards the end, in the latter half, Isaiah's writing makes a massive change. And all of a sudden, he becomes this master of beautiful and just evocative poetry. Isaiah 41, verse 10. Jonathan brought this up to me. Jonathan Biesecker was talking about Isaiah and how this verse was just really big. Someone had shared this with him. Isaiah 41, 10. Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. And that's just one verse. And you can tell, have a sense, what's going on before it and what's going on after it. This is just beautiful and moving and rolling. This is kind of like high and powerful poetry. And the first five chapters is in your face punchy things like, chapter 1, verse 8, the daughter of Zion is left like a booth in a vineyard, like a lodge in a cucumber field, like a besieged city. Well, that's not high poetry. You guys are like a lodge in a cucumber field. That's not beautiful. And so these are different kinds of expressions, and I think that's really exciting and trying to see those differences and try to understand what the differences might point to. All right, so we're going to read verses 2 through 9. We're going to go through the whole chapter, but I want to do it in sections. Isaiah chapter 1, we'll start with verse 2. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. Children have I reared up and brought up, but they rebelled against me. The ox knows its owner, and the donkey its master's crib, but Israel does not know. My people do not understand. Ugh, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, offspring of evildoers, children who deal corruptly. They've forsaken the Lord. They've despised the Holy One of Israel. They are utterly estranged. Why will you be struck down? Why will you continue to rebel? The whole head is sick and the whole heart is faint. From the sole of the foot even to the head, there is no soundness in it, but bruises and sores and raw wounds. They're not pressed out or bound up or softened with oil. Your country lies desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. In your very presence, foreigners devour your land. It is desolate, as overthrown by foreigners. And the daughter of Zion is left like a booth in a vineyard, like a lodge in a cucumber field, like a besieged city. If the Lord of hosts had not left us a few survivors, we should have been like Sodom and become like Gomorrah. I'm stopping there, because I want to stop there. You read on, there's kind of a twist. So this is how he's opening up the message here. It's fun to wonder, was this written after the Assyrian Empire surrounded Jerusalem in the days of Hezekiah, or before? Right? We don't know when. He could have said this, look outside, there's waste and destruction. And they all look out and they say, no, there isn't. That's one of the senses that we need to get into our mind, that he could have been saying that these are the things that are coming. You are wasted. And they look out their windows and they say, no, we're not. And then a few years later, he repeats the sermon, you are wasted. And they look out their windows and they see that they are, right? Is there any doubt to the father's skill and training and wisdom? And father there is a capital F. There is a lot of, you can have a lot of doubt in my skill and training and wisdom. But the father, is there any doubt when God says, children have I reared up and brought up, but they have rebelled against me? Do you think you can say, yeah, God, but you made a mistake when you did this and you could have done this better. You know, you should have. No. God is the father. He is the good father in the Bible. And there are so many bad fathers in the Bible. In chapter 5, he talks about he's done all this work to make this beautiful vineyard. And he was looking for grapes. Man, he got wild grapes. What's the deal? I think Jesus uses almost the same parable, image for a parable. There's no doubt to God's skill in being a father, in training the animal. And they're a mess. He says, even an ox knows what to do. And you're dumber than an ox, right? Those aren't literally the words that he says, but that's the point. The ox knows its owner, but Israel doesn't know. You're dumber than an ox. This is speaking to their heart, sayings that they would be thinking, whether they said them out loud or not, things like, well, I should do such and such, but I don't have to. Or maybe I know what's right, but I'm going to do this anyway, because this can be right as well. So much of this chapter makes me think of the Good Samaritan. The two guys who walk by an opportunity to be right and to do right and to share God's righteousness, and they walk right on by. They didn't do the right thing. And so what is Israel in verse 4? Count up the sin words. Sinful. Laden with iniquity. They are of evildoers. They deal corruptly. They're forsaken and they're despised by the Lord. That's a lot of problems in one verse. And this is written to a bunch of people who are living through 3 out of 4 good kings. Good kings that are 3 out of 4, right? This is a rough sermon. In verses 5 through 9, he goes, why did you let yourselves get this way? You are beat up. You are torn up. It's like you've twisted your ankle out of joint and you're refusing to wear an ankle brace. And why do guys refuse to wear an ankle brace? Because they're guys and we don't need that kind of stuff. And they're hobbling around and they make it worse, right? Why didn't you like press out? The descriptions of healing the wound sounds kind of weird, right? You're not pressing it out or binding it up or softening it with oil. No, just let it get all scabby and hard. And then ow, it's like, no, you need, clean out the wound and cover it with, we don't cover it with oil, but isn't a lot of the salves essentially made out of oils, right? So the language is a little bit different. Why aren't you doing the things to actually heal? You're bruised and beat up and you don't have any soundness in you. Why aren't you doing this? These are people who are avoiding medical treatment. It's as if the light has come into the world and men love the darkness rather than the light. So why do people do this? This is a frustrating truth about mankind, about us, right? People who avoid doing the right thing and instead they do the wrong thing. One truth that I've heard somebody say, and I've been able to see this in many instances through my life and thinking back into old experiences and seeing as new ones are coming up, how people who are hurting, right, they have pain and they have difficulties, whether it's physical and literal on the outside or emotional on the inside or spiritual or something going on. Hurting people, they hurt people. That's just what happens. You know, you're in a bad mood, someone says a thing, and you lash out. Hurting people, they hurt people. And they also, hurting people, they hurt the help that is trying to come toward them. And they don't want to ask for help because it hurts to admit that you have a problem. It hurts to look at your own problem. It hurts to work and repair that problem. Why did you let that thing get all scabby? Because it was gross and I didn't want to look at it. Or why didn't you clean it out? Do you know how much it hurts to clean grass and dirt and stuff out of a wound? That hurts a lot. Well, yeah. Do you know how much it hurts to have grass and dirt in a wound for a long time? I don't want to go through that kind of pain. Well, you're going to have a different kind of pain, right? It hurts to work. It hurts to repair. It hurts to ask for help. Why does it hurt to ask for help? Because if I'm asking for help, it shows that I'm defeated. Well, you are defeated, right? You've been defeated. You need to ask for help because asking for help is what gets you toward victory. And we get ourselves all turned around. And so we need to have opened eyes. Look, your country is desolate. It's all on fire. Foreigners are everywhere. It's a mess. And you're just proud of your little lodge in a cucumber field. Man, the translators love trying to figure out that one. I just have this image of you know, somebody built a deer stand in their cucumber field, like as this protective place that they're going to defend it from the foreigners. It's like, guys, it's like you're defending your pickle farm. There are so many things that are wrong, and this is what you've erected to protect yourself. And he's asking them to open their eyes. During your self-examination, what will you let yourself see? We've got our lodge. We've got our thing. Man, it's a good thing. I mean, if God hadn't been with us, we'd have been destroyed like Sodom and Gomorrah. That's how it ends. It's kind of an extreme statement. Let's start in verse 9 again. We'll read 9 through 15. If the Lord of hosts had not left us a few survivors, we should have been like Sodom and become like Gomorrah. Hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom. Give ear to the teaching of our God, you people of Gomorrah. What is it to me, the multitude of your sacrifices, says the Lord? I've had enough of burnt offerings of rams and the fat of well-fed beasts. I do not delight in the blood of bulls or of lambs or of goats. When you come to appear before me, who is required of you this trampling of my courts? Bring no more vain offerings. Incense is an abomination to me. New moons and Sabbath and the calling of convocations. I cannot endure iniquity in solemn assembly. Your new moons and your appointed feasts, my soul hates. They have become a burden to me. I'm weary of bearing them. When you spread out your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not listen, for your hands are full of blood. Wash yourselves. And he continues on with that. This is awful. Man, it's a good thing we're not like Sodom and Gomorrah. You know, at least we have God on our side. At least we're going to church. What? You know, verse 10 is one of those wait, what moments. Man, if we didn't have God on our side, we'd become like Sodom and Gomorrah. And God says, well, open up your ears, Sodom. That's rude. You know, God shouldn't be so rude, right? I mean, the prophet is hollering at them. They're dirty with sin, but full of worship. That's what all these verses are. Count up all the sin descriptors and synonyms and practices. And count up all the worship practices. They got calloused hearts, but boy, they are particular in their worship, aren't they? Isn't that interesting? It's a little bit like Jesus in Matthew 23 and all the troubles that he describes with the Pharisees. Man, you're straining a gnat, but you're swallowing a camel. But we didn't get the gnat, you know. Doesn't that count for something? You know, does the gnat count for anything when you're swallowing camels? What strikes me about these verses here, we're about to get into the emotions that God has when we are doing this stuff. Worship isn't submission and obedience to God. Now, when you submit and obey God, worship's a part. But can you worship God without submission and obedience? These verses say so. Do you know of people who worship the Lord and do so without submission and obedience? I do. Just because we worship, just because we practice, just because we've been practicing at practicing, God is trying to wake them up to this mess. You know, Jesus says in Mark chapter 2, verse 27, the Sabbath was made for man. Don't worship worship. That's supposed to help us in our connection with God. And look at God's feelings. I can't endure iniquity and solemn assembly. All right? Your new moons and your appointed feasts, in verse 14, my soul hates. They've become a burden, and I'm weary. When you pray, I hide. What is God feeling here? This is intense stuff. This is shocking language. He hates. It's a burden. It's weary. In Malachi chapter 1, verse 10, so way at the end of the New Testament, God says, I wish someone would just shut the doors. If this is what you're doing, just shut the doors. Whoa. Can you ever imagine God? You don't have to imagine it. He said it. Can you ever imagine God saying, man, if that's what you're doing at church, just shut the doors and lock them? That's his attitude here. This is a loud prophet, no matter how soft his voice is. 1 Corinthians 11, right? There's a good example. When you come together, it is not for the better, but it is for the worst, right? When you come together as a church to take communion, you are divided. If you're not sharing the communion, isn't communion and sharing actually synonyms? So if you aren't sharing the sharing, if you're not communing and do you see how that's a mess? And how they're doing a practice, but they're not doing what it was about. That's really interesting to me. I don't know if they were, you know, adding in all sorts of extra stuff in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, but when they came together, they didn't come together. And that's really what the problem was. I think that's a neat New Testament connection. And so, you know, one illustration of this might look like, how would you describe bad congregational singing? Off key or bad heart, right? Man, we sound awful, but I know we're singing to the Lord. Well, don't say we sound awful. That's just rude. But like, what are we going to work on? Are we going to work on our voice or on our heart, right? And so this is a neat thing that Isaiah is pointing us toward. You can be technically correct and rotten on the inside, right? Man, that's just Pharisee all over. Well, we'll pick up in verse 16. 16 through 20 is really pretty. Don't worry, we got through that's rotten, that's rough. We're getting to something beautiful. Verse 16, wash yourselves, make yourselves clean. Remove the evil of your deeds from before my eyes. Cease to do evil, learn to do good. Seek justice, correct oppression. Bring justice to the fatherless. Plead the widow's cause. Come now, let's reason together, says the Lord. Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they're red like crimson, they shall become like wool. If you are willing and obedient, you shall eat of the good of the land. But if you refuse and rebel, you shall be eaten by the sword. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken. Okay, this sermon, not mine, Isaiah's. Isaiah's sermon is still more about condemnation than hope, right? But this is a beautiful moment of hope. And he comes in here and he says, don't be technically correct and rotten on the inside. You need to wash yourselves and you need to do good. And don't get me wrong, if we are going to worship and assemble and do practices for God, we have to do them the way God wants them to. So I'm not just, you know, saying do whatever we want in worship. But there is more in doing good than getting some of these practices right. Well, Isaiah, what should we start doing? The list he gives us is tremendous. Remove the evil deeds from before my eyes. Well, like what? Cease to do evil, learn to do good. Well, like what? Because those aren't very specific, right? Okay. Seek justice, correct oppression. Well, what do you mean by that? Bring justice to the fatherless and plead the widow's cause. Pure and undefiled religion before the Lord is what? Going to the fatherless and going to the widow. So much of the prophets is not about making sure that the practices and that the Passover was done right, but rather that the people make themselves right and get their interconnected behavior right. They were ignoring people, they were dropping people, and they were losing people because of that. And so you need to get up and, well, then we can go to Matthew chapter 5 and 6 and 7. Now, that's a sermon that tells you what these sorts of things are going to be like. Going the extra mile, letting your light shine. If someone hits you on the right cheek, you turn it off for the other, you don't fight back. There's all these practices that you do. If you're going to do a good deed with your right hand, don't let your left hand know. Don't make it about boasting. When you are praying to the Lord, remember that when you're asking for forgiveness, that you need to forgive others, right? All sorts of these going above and beyond, which is so much of what Jesus is talking about. I think it fits in with this. The behaviors of caring and doing good. And these are things that we see, right? I have seen Christians who foster and adopt. I've seen Christians who help widows, who feed, well, maybe they don't, they help feed the ones who are feeding the newborns, I'll put it that way. Donations and giving and caring and seeking out. There's a good email service saying there's a need, and everyone jumps on that email and acts with it, right? There is a lot of good Samaritan behaviors that Christians do. So, you know, we got to keep that up. God doesn't call simply for better for worship, but for better love. He wants us to be good Samaritans. He wants us to see someone on the wayside and stop on the wayside and behave in that. And what's connected to that? Cleanliness, righteousness, holiness. You are red head to toe and you can be cleaned white. I don't do the laundry, but I know that red's the worst. You know, I know I'm in trouble if I spill red. And you will be made whiter than snow. You'll be white like wool. And this dramatic change is what we see in the New Testament baptism idea. But the heart to make that change is needed in baptism, and it's needed every day after baptism. That's what this lesson from Isaiah is about, right? He's not just do it today. He's live it through your life. Because God's got this offer that he's offered to us. Offer that he's offered. 19 and 20, I think this one's fun. If you're willing and obedient, and then verse 20, but if you refuse and rebel. But look at the offers, I think this is fun. If you're willing and obedient, you shall eat the good of the land. But if you refuse and rebel, you'll be eaten by the sword. I love that. I just think that's a great little poem. The book of Isaiah has got a lot of fun moments like that. If you're willing and you listen and you hearken, you know, Jesus, who wanted to bring them in like the hen brings the chicks under her wings, but they were unwilling. That's the phrase, that's the word that Jesus uses there. We need to be willing and obedient and submissive. We need to hear, not just listen, but hear and get engaged in that. But if you refuse and rebel, why would people refuse that? Why were they refusing that? Or what were they refusing? You know, when I first worked on this lesson, I was holding on. They're refusing this honest self-examination. That's me just shoving that phrase back in there because that's what I wanted the sermon to be about. I really think that they're refusing the cleansing and the submission connected to that cleansing. And if you don't look at yourself very hard, it's easier to refuse that. The rest of this chapter is just Isaiah hammering it home. So why do we refuse, right? That's one of the big questions. And I keep coming to this in my sermons because I'm thinking about it a lot. Maybe you guys have answers and you can just tell me and I'll stop hammering you with my thoughts on this. The idea of, I know what I look like. I've seen myself in a mirror. But maybe I haven't let the law of liberty be the thing that I look at myself with. I'm wondering if there's a difference there in James 1. There are the people who look at themselves in the mirror and then they even forget what they look like. But if I look at, if I examine the law of liberty, if I use the law of God and God's word as the very tool that I examine myself in, I'm going to see a lot better in myself. A good example of someone who couldn't see himself is Luke 18 and the Pharisee who prayed thus to himself or with himself. I can't remember the preposition. What a terrible way to have your prayer described. He prayed thus with himself. Well, I guess he didn't involve God. He had no idea what he looked like, even though he described himself in the whole prayer. But the other man knew. Examining and looking at other people is often a lot more comfortable. Well, we need to do uncomfortable things. Sometimes my identity and who I am is wrapped up in the fact that at least I'm not that. And I definitely don't do that. And those people are those things. And I haven't said anything about me. It was in the lesson this morning. I've the idea of cleaning out all the problems in my head. I've cleaned out all those bad spirits. But I haven't even found out what I am. And even more can come in and fill me with more evil. I think there's a lot of fear in looking at ourselves and seeing what we look like. And we're afraid of the changes that we're going to have to make because we're afraid of the demands that's going to be connected to that. And I don't know what life is going to be like after I change. It's so comfortable walking around with this scabby arm because I know where the hurt is. And if I change it, if I start working on it, go to physical. Physical therapy is the worst, guys. Those of you who've been to physical therapy know. If I go to physical therapy, it's going to be awful. Well, it's because I'm just refusing to look past it, refusing to understand the hope. God's offering so much to us. The closer we get to God, the more we're going to have to change. But God never changes. I think this is what Isaiah is calling us to do. All right, let's read 21 through 26. We're pretty much done with all the nice verses. I'll just give you a heads up. How the faithful city has become a whore. She is who was full of justice. Righteousness is lodged in her, but now murderers. Your silver has become dross, your best wine mixed with water. Your princes are rebels and companions of thieves. Everyone loves a bribe and runs after gifts. They do not bring justice to the fatherless, and the widow's cause has not come before them. Therefore the Lord declares, the Lord of hosts, the mighty one of Israel, I will get relief from my enemies and avenge myself on my foes. I will turn my hand against you and will smelt away your dross as with lye and remove all your alloy. And I will restore your judges as at the first and your counselors as at the beginning. Afterwards, you shall be called the city of righteousness, the faithful city. Now, you can use verse 26 as your, you know, little piece of hope at the end. The message, though, is I am going to burn out all of y'all's problems, and then I will have something good at the end. And the message isn't, oh, goody, I can't wait for the good at the end. The message really is, wait, am I going to get burned? Right? Like, these are rough verses. God is pulling the curtain back. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. God, don't pull my curtain back. Don't take a look at what I am. Don't show me what I am. God pulls the curtain back, and the people are looking at themselves, and they are dirtier than they thought they were. In a time of good kings, they grew tarnished and watered down. Right? They were murderers and rebels and thieves. They took bribes. They were seeking after them. They weren't seeking justice. They weren't seeking right causes. They were seeking gifts and bribes. Usually, bribe me and give me a gift so that I can support your court case rather than uphold the righteous cause court case. And God's going to get his relief. Verse 24, I think it is. I will get my relief from my enemies. You say it, God. Yeah, get the enemies. Who's his enemies? His enemies in this chapter is his children. Oh, I don't like this verse anymore. That's a reaction. James 4:4. You adulterous people, don't you know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. James 4:4 is saying the same kind of thing. He's not saying those adulterous people. He's saying you adulterous people. These authors are trying to get us to look at ourselves and to think about it. God's children cause his grief, and relieving his grief is smelting out the dross and melting the alloys. That doesn't sound fun. It sounds a little bit painful. It doesn't sound beautiful. It doesn't sound like a washing and regeneration. There's some pretty words about those kinds of change. This sounds kind of gross and dirty and dark and tarnish and waste and gross and painful. And I don't like this. And Isaiah is trying to say, well, you need to wake up, Dan, because this is what's coming. God's going to restore things back to the original way. And to get back to the original there in verse 26, he's going to have to burn me off, or burn part of me off, right? Verse 27 to the end. Zion shall be redeemed by justice, and those in her who repent by righteousness. But rebels and sinners shall be broken together, and those who forsake the Lord shall be consumed. For they shall be ashamed of the oaks that you desired, and you shall blush for the gardens that you have chosen. For you shall be like an oak whose leaf withers, and a garden without water, and the strong shall become tinder, and his work a spark, and both of them shall burn together with none to quench them. There's some funny phrases and words here. You're going to be ashamed of oaks. Not that oak trees are sinful trees. I think this is referencing the Asherah poles, or basically the totem poles and the oak trees and the groves, these places of idolatry. You're going to be ashamed of those things and the groves where they were planting them. You're going to be ashamed of those gardens that you were desiring. I do believe it's okay to have a garden. This is talking about, this is a poetic reference to the idolatry that they were going to, right? Zion's going to be redeemed. Zion's going to be cleaned up. Is this a statement of hope or a statement of fact? Right? Kind of depends upon your perspective and where you are and how you're behaving. If you're ugly, you're just, God's going to do it. But if you are in an environment that is ugly and you are holding on, there is this hope for you, right? But the rebels and the sinners and those who forsake the Lord, they're going to be consumed. They're going to have shame for what they've been desiring and choosing. And what are they going to be like in verse 30? Man, they're going to be like an oak. They're going to be like an oak tree whose leaf withers. Oh, and like a garden without water. Oak trees are awesome, right? You might pick your favorite tree. Oak trees are often quite awesome, and they're big. And they're just like, and they're great. In Rhode Island, I'd never seen so many oak trees in my life. Everything was an oak tree. Everything, everything, everything. And they all were falling over dead. It was just unbelievable. They were huge. They were big around. They had no guts. They had no insides. They were cracking and falling over. I lived next to a park, and we lost, I don't know, two or three trees every storm that came through. Big, beautiful, massive, awesome oaks that were dead. And this chapter just kept coming to mind. You shall be like an oak whose leaf withers in the garden without water. And the strong shall become tinder, and his work a spark. And both of them shall burn together with none to quench them. You do know that oak wood is just about the best firewood you'll ever get. I just love the irony and the poetry in that. Oh, these mighty oaks. Oh, the people of Judah and Jerusalem that were strong and majestic and big, and they had, I'm talking oaks here, bellies that were massive. They were hollow and rotten on the inside. And God's going to just blow them over. And they're going to burn. And it's going to be good firewood. It's going to burn hot. And that's not a pretty image. But not everyone. I mean, We see that. We've seen that here in chapter 1. You get to the second half of Isaiah, it's very clear it's not everyone. This is a good introduction to Isaiah. I hope that it can be encouraging to you to read the book. It's not going to be all this depressing, but a lot of it is. I mean, it's the prophets, right? But really cool imagery, really powerful messages of, man, I'm a mess. I need to get myself together. I need to be better than a mighty oak. I need to grow well. We'll close by looking at Psalm 1, because Psalm 1 is just so similar to Isaiah 1 here at the end. And I don't know where you are in your life with your behavior and your needs, but Isaiah is perfect for you because it's covering everybody. I don't know if it's covering the brand new Christian who's full of joy, because there's not a lot of joy in Isaiah 1, so, you know, bear with me there if this seemed a little bit depressing. But this is perfect for someone who is wondering about their state with God and whether they need to join themselves to God. Isaiah is saying, man, step up. And it's really perfect for the Christian who knows what they're doing. Because God is saying, I don't think you know what you're doing as well as you think you know what you're doing. Wake up. Think about yourself. Are you just putting more supporting beams on a lodge in a cucumber field? Because that's kind of silly. You know, take a good look at your life. And we need to be like Psalm 1. Blessed is the man that walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law does he meditate day and night. He shall be like a tree planted by the streams of water that brings forth its fruit in its season, whose leaf also does not wither, and whatsoever he does shall prosper. The wicked aren't so, but are like the chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore the wicked shall not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the ways of the righteous, but the way of the wicked shall perish. And I hope that we can use Isaiah as a call to spiritually come forward to God with our lives. And if any of you need to come forward and ask for prayers and ask for help, why don't you do so as we stand together and sing?